Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Since the early 1990s, more than 2,000 young women and children as young as 10 say that they have been sexually exploited, abused, and raped by UN peacekeepers on missions around the world. The United Nations says it's trying to end this abuse, but it keeps happening. Over the past year, the UN has introduced new measures to deal with this crisis. Only 53 uniformed peacekeepers and one civilian on UN assignment have been sent to jail for sexual offenses. Today's guest, journalist Ramita Navai, producer and director Sam Collins, and their team traveled the world to find out why these measures have not been effective and why people are not being held accountable. The result of the investigation is a PBS Frontline documentary that airs tonight called UN Sex Abuse Scandal. You can also find it online, and you can watch the trailer at yourcallradio.org. Ramita Navai spoke with survivors, officials, and witnesses to better understand what is going on. Ramita Navai is an award-winning British-Iranian journalist who has reported from over 35 countries. She has worked on more than 20 documentaries, including the Emmy Award-winning Frontline documentary, Syria Undercover. She was the Tehran correspondent for The Times from 2003 to 2006, and she's the author of the book, City of Lives, Love, Sex, Death, and the Search for Truth in Tehran. And Ramita Navai joins us from London. Hi, Ramita. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for the incredible work that you do and that you've done on this documentary. You travel to many countries to speak to young girls who say that they were raped by UN peacekeepers. Before we dive in and talk about what you found, give us a sense of what is happening here. Over the past 15 years, the UN has recorded about 2,000 allegations of sexual abuse by peacekeepers in zones around the world. We're talking about the Democratic Republic of Congo, Kosovo, East Timor, Tahiti. Can you first off give us a thumbnail sketch of what's actually happening here?
The shocking thing is that this has been happening for a long time. So if we start kind of 1990s, UN police were trafficking women in Bosnia, and it's been happening all the way through the 2000s up until the present. And what's striking is that it's still happening. Even though this has been logged by the UN, cases have been investigated, there have been studies, there have been reforms, none of it has stopped this.
And why is that? I mean, you spoke with a number of UN officials who said the problem is the member countries are the ones that have to deal with this, and they're not.
This is where it gets kind of interesting and complicated. So, you know, everyone seems to pass the buck. So where does the buck kind of stop? So the UN is made up of member states. And how much power does the Secretary General have to make member states adopt policies which could fight this, which could help this? The answer is, well, there's only so much that the Secretary General can do. If member states are not willing to adopt reforms that will help fight an issue like sex abuse.
So can you elaborate on that? We're talking about 193 governments, and people you interviewed in your film said that the UN cannot impose on member states a new judicial system. Home countries have to take action. So why aren't home countries taking action? And can you be specific when we're talking about home countries, which ones are at the top of the list?
So when peacekeepers rape or abuse, you've got two different types of peacekeepers. You've got your uniformed peacekeepers, your soldiers, and you've got your civilian peacekeepers. And depending on who the perpetrator is, there are different processes in place for accountability, for justice. Now, if it's a soldier, if it's a uniformed peacekeeper, only the troop-contributing country, so the country that's contributed that soldier or uniformed policeman, only that country can try him. And they'll try him back home in a military court, probably. Now, in all of the allegations, and as you said, there have been, you know, thousands of allegations, only 53 uniformed peacekeepers have ever been jailed, even when there have been substantiated cases. So even there, when there have been cases that the UN itself has investigated, has said, listen, yes, abuse, rape, exploitation has happened, but it's up to the troop contributing country to mete out justice, to try that person. In reality, it's not happening. For civilians, it's even worse. So if you're a civilian peacekeeper, the most the UN can do is sack you, because they don't have jurisdiction. It's then up to the home country, the country where that civilian peacekeeper is from, to try you. Now, if that home country, and this is where it gets a little bit complicated, if that home country doesn't have extraterritorial jurisdiction, and about a half of countries in the world don't, that means you can commit a crime in another country and never be tried for it, because you're not in your home country's jurisdiction. That's what's going wrong, essentially. Accountability is at the heart of this. And the figures, you know, like I said, the figures are shocking. Only one international civilian peacekeeper has ever been jailed for sexual abuse.
You spoke with a number of members of the UN. You spoke with Isabel Coleman, a U.S. ambassador to the UN for management and reform. She served from 2014 to 2017. And she said that member countries don't always have the ability to collect evidence or mount an investigation against an alleged perpetrator. She said that there's catastrophic loopholes here. So what would it take to close those loopholes, and why isn't it happening?
So there have been suggestions, many suggestions, about closing those loopholes. One of them has been having in-situ court-martials. So you set up a court where the crime has happened. And that would help because, first of all, access to witnesses. So what often happens is, if a soldier commits a crime and he's sent back home to his country, the home country who's trying him, the judicial system there, will say, well, where are the witnesses? We don't have any witnesses. And they can't fly in witnesses, often they just don't bother, or sometimes they can't afford it. We were told in the case of Congolese soldiers who were being tried in Congo for crimes perpetrated in the Central African Republic, they said, well, we simply can't afford flying witnesses over. So that's the first point. The second point is access to evidence. Evidence is lost. If you're not near the scene of the crime, you can't properly investigate this. So they're crucial.
And give us a sense of who these peacekeepers are. You have specific situations and stories, for example, UN peacekeepers who were stationed in the Democratic Republic of Congo amid a bloody civil war almost 20 years ago were from France. And in this particular case, we'll talk about this in a couple of minutes, Didier Bouguet, who was working at the UN peacekeeping mission in Goma, is white, and he's from France. Can you give us a sense of who these other peacekeepers are? Who are we talking about exactly?
They are peacekeepers from every single nation that you can imagine. Wherever there are peacekeepers, there's a high possibility that there will be a chance of finding sexual exploitation, sexual abuse, and rape perpetrated by peacekeepers. Some countries are worse offenders than others, but generally it's pretty round the board. And they're in peacekeeping missions. Abuse has been happening in peacekeeping missions all around the world.
So this is happening by peacekeepers in, for example, European countries, other countries, but then also in the home country.
Yes. So, you know, you were talking about the French peacekeepers that were operating in the Central African Republic. There was a group of French peacekeepers, and it was a big scandal, and they were found to, well, they were alleged to have raped many children. Many children testified, it came out, many children gave evidence that they had been raped. We met one little girl, Daniela. She was 10 years old, and there was fighting in Bangui, the capital of the Central African Republic. So many people had fled to a refugee camp by the airport. This refugee camp by the airport was controlled by French peacekeepers sent there to protect the local population. Daniela was another little girl, and this happened to many children at this refugee camp. She was walking past the French peacekeeper base. She was called over by some men. And children are very trusting in the Central African Republic, especially if you're a white person. You know, this is something I heard again and again, which was really interesting. They'd say to me, but he was white. White people don't lie. We trust the white man. I mean, it was really extraordinary. You know, it kind of blew me away. I wasn't expecting that. They were incredibly trusting and naive. She was called over by, you know, guys in men in uniform who offered to give her water. And, of course, she's a little girl, and she listens to what adults tell her to do. She was raped by both of them, age 10, really badly injured, and went home to her father. There was fighting and war, so it was very difficult to get her medical attention. They managed to get her some antibiotics, and they didn't report her case. They didn't know how to report her case to the UN. So this was another case that was unlogged by the UN, and that tells us something really important. It tells us that the figures that the UN publishes on its website, because the UN is trying to be very transparent about this, the UN publishes all these figures of allegations of rape, are they substantiated, are they not, publishes these figures on their website. What it told me is that these figures are pretty meaningless, because we met so many children and women who told us that they had been raped or abused or exploited, and who had never reported their cases to the UN, so the UN didn't even know. So I think these figures are just the tip of the iceberg.
And can you tell us specifically what happened with that case? And why were the charges ultimately dismissed?
So that case was investigated for a few years. The French sent over investigators there. I mean, ultimately that case came out. That's a really interesting case. That case came out because there was a whistleblower within the UN who saw that the testimonies of these children were just sitting, as he put it, sitting on the desks of officials, and they were going from inbox to inbox, being emailed around, and nothing was being done. So these victims were still out there, and there was no help, there was nothing, that these cases were not being properly investigated. So this senior UN official, when he realizes this, he blew the whistle. And that's how this case came out, really, and came to media attention. The French sent investigators. The UN had already investigated. So also we must remember that children are now being interviewed, you know, multiple times sometimes, which is pretty harrowing for them. And the case was thrown out of the French courts the beginning of this year. Now, they said that it didn't mean that the abuse didn't happen. There simply wasn't sufficient evidence to prove it. And, you know, what is sufficient evidence? The children would get facts wrong, you know, their children. But sometimes, you know, the children would describe, and this is what was surprising to me, they would describe, you know, tattoos in intimate places that correlated with UN investigators' reports and even French investigators' reports. And these are tattoos that you'd have to see someone naked to see tattoos in these places. You have to be really up close to these soldiers to see these little details that they reported. However, the French courts threw the case out. They said there wasn't enough evidence, so nothing has happened to these soldiers.
Today we are speaking with Ramita Navai, an award-winning journalist who has reported from over 35 countries. She did the reporting for the new PBS Frontline documentary. It's airing tonight. It's called UN Sex Abuse Scandal, and you can see the trailer at yourcallradio.org. Ramita spoke with survivors, officials, and witnesses to better understand this. The film starts out by saying some of the world's most vulnerable men, women, and children have been exploited by UN peacekeepers who are supposed to be protecting them. And if you have any questions for Ramita, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Ramita, on Twitter, Andrew asks, why only use UN figures? According, for example, since the early 90s, more than 2,000 young women and children as young as 10 have been sexually exploited and abused. Where does that 2,000 number come from?
The official number of peacekeepers is just over 1,700 that the UN itself has logged. It has a website where it logs abuses perpetrated by peacekeepers. Now, there are abuses perpetrated by non-peacekeepers as well. So UN staff that aren't peacekeepers, we were just concentrating on peacekeepers. Peacekeepers can be civilian and they can be military. So whenever the UN, a child in the Democratic Republic of Congo gets abused and raped, they will go and tell the UN. If they go and tell the UN, of course, when they do that, the UN will log it on their website, and that's where these figures come from. And the UN has only been publishing these figures for about the last 15 years. And I think there were two reports before this website started. But that's getting pretty granular now. But, facts and figures in the UN, trying to get them is a bit like wading through treacle. But we managed it in the end.
Right, because
I say to Andrew, who's tweeted, I would say, just to remember, these figures are just the tip of the iceberg, I think. Within a few days, both in the Central African Republic and in the Democratic Republic of Congo, we came across so many women and children who told us they had been raped, abused, exploited, and they had never told the UN. So the UN had no idea of their existence.
Mm. He cites a Swedish report that found 58,000 examples of sexual abuse by the UN over 9 years.
I've never heard that 58,000 figure. That doesn't sound right to me. I've never come across that. The figure of abuse by UN staff and peacekeepers is higher than the 1,700, but it's nowhere near 53,000.
All right. Well, Andrew, if you have a link, if you can tweet that to us, that would be great. Thank you. Ramita, what's so amazing about your documentary is that you actually spoke to the young girls and the boys who said that they were abused and raped. How did you find them?
You know, this is one of the things that really was striking for me. It was so easy to find them, partly because of the stigma attached to them, that everybody knew about them. So you'd start to spread the word, and everybody knew this person, that person, that person's daughter, that person's sister has been abused or raped, because it was a thing of shame. That was particularly distressing, to talk to little children who understood that they lived with absolute shame, and some of them couldn't leave their houses through the stigma, were condemned to, you know, staying at home. Some of them had stopped going to school. But we found them through our network of brilliant field producers. And these are local journalists who have been working on this issue and who've been working with charities there, who just spread the word.
I mean, every single story is just horrific. And these girls obviously are so brave to tell these stories. You interviewed Annie, a 13-year-old who lives in the Democratic Republic of Congo. She says that rebels there killed her mom and her dad and then raped her. She said that she fled for her life. After she left her village, government soldiers came, rounded people up, and raped them. And then she met a UN peacekeeper from South Africa. They were sent to protect the local population. And she said he also raped her and gave her a dollar. I mean, this is just, she lost both of her parents and then she was raped multiple times by different people. How common is this?
This is the story of Congo. I mean, Annie's story is the story of women in this part of Congo. So, as you said, raped by M23 rebels. This is after seeing her parents and her siblings killed in front of her. Thinks she's saved because government soldiers take over her town. Government soldiers go on a rampage and rape all the women and children in her village. While she's fleeing, she's raped by the UN peacekeeper. I mean, you know, I think the UN calls this repeat victims, but this is the story of Congo. Already in the Congo, women have suffered from mass rapes. It's been, you know, really widely documented. That's what makes this story even more shocking. The very people who were sent in to protect these women from the rapes that were happening to them, did this to them. I mean, talking to Annie was, you know, it was devastating, and she's still suffering hugely. By the way, yeah, so she was about 14 at the time. She's a little older now when it happened. But she's still, you know, she's a teenager now. She's still a child, and she's struggling to cope with what happened to her.
Are there any resources available to help young girls like Annie?
Well, Annie has, so she's working with a local charity. So she has a psychologist who's been giving her psychosocial counseling. So she is lucky. The minute you leave the big cities, the minute you're in the towns, there's nothing. There are no resources for these children and for these young women. In the Central African Republic, we met a young girl called Manda. And she was 11 years old when she was raped by a peacekeeper from the Democratic Republic of Congo. She soon got pregnant, and she had the baby, and she's 14 now with a little baby. And she hadn't told the UN. She, when we asked her, her and her mother just looked at us blankly, like, how do we tell the UN? Where is the UN? You know, where do we go? They had absolutely no idea, completely clueless. And there's nothing for girls like her, no support.
Manda told you that, quote, after he had sex with me, he gave me money. This seemed to be a theme with the girls that you interviewed. One said he gave me a couple dollars, and then $5, and then $15. Is this what you found over and over again, that these men rape these girls and then give them money?
In many cases, they did. In some cases, no. But in lots of cases, they'd give them money, or they'd give them, you know, a little bit of food. And so this horrific cycle of abuse starts, where they go back to the child, and then the child is under a lot of pressure because the child has a starving family. And when I say starving, I really mean, you know, they do not have enough food to eat. So we did find that. And that, you know, opens up a really interesting question about what the UN calls exploitation, which is having sex with prostitutes. You know, in this case, I mean, the UN is very clear. If a child, and they view a child as being 18 years or under, if you have, even if it's, you know, sex for money with a child, it's considered rape, because a child under the age of 18 can't consent. But what was interesting is that, you know, even over the age of 18, it's viewed as exploitation, not rape, if you have sex for money. What was striking for me is, being on the ground, you know, I think it is a debate in the West, you know, is it right, is it wrong, you know, let's discuss prostitution, it's consensual, is it consensual? Once you're on the ground in these countries, you realize this is not a choice. And I went there with a very open mind, but I was so struck when I got on the ground there that this is not a choice, that this is exploitation, simply because of the power dynamic, and because these people are starving. And they're not doing this out of choice or because they want to. They're doing this because they need food. They need to feed their families, and they need to feed themselves.
Also, how can anyone say that a 13-year-old is making a choice to do this? I mean, that's...
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's where the UN is clear. So a child has no choice, and that is deemed as rape. But, of course, you know, peacekeepers, to justify it... peacekeepers will say that it's consensual. And you know, when we spoke to... So we spoke to one French civilian peacekeeper. He is the only international civilian peacekeeper ever to have been jailed. He's called Didier Bourguet. Mm. And he admitted to us to raping 20, 25 children when he was serving in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Before that, he was also in the Central African Republic, and he raped children in the Central African Republic. And he was caught for doing this, and he was tried in a court in France. And he was paying children, and that's how he justifies this. It was really horrific talking to him, and talking to him justifying raping children.
Mm. Well, we're going to take a quick break, and after the break, we'll talk more about Didier Bouguet and his case, how you found him, and the horrific things he did to some of the most vulnerable children on the planet. We're talking today with Ramita Navai. She's an award-winning journalist who has reported from over 35 countries, and she did the reporting for the new PBS Frontline documentary that is airing tonight. It's called UN Sex Abuse Scandal. It is really horrific and heart-wrenching, but it is so important to amplify the voices of especially these children who have been exploited, and you can find the trailer at yourcallradio.org. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll talk about the new documentary, Dark Money. The film examines the influence of untraceable corporate money in elections. It shows the real-life impact of Citizens United and the shocking truth of how elections are bought and sold. Well, actually, it is shocking, but we've been talking about this for years, and we all know about how this works, but we'll talk about what people across the country are doing to take money out of politics. Today, we are speaking with Ramita Navai, an award-winning journalist who has reported from over 35 countries. She has worked on more than 20 documentaries, including the Emmy Award-winning Frontline documentary, Syria Undercover. Her new documentary is called UN Sex Abuse Scandal, and it airs tonight on PBS. You can watch the trailer at yourcallradio.org. And if you have any questions for Ramita about sex abuse and rape by UN peacekeepers on missions around the world, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Before we talk about Didier Bouguet, let's take a few questions from listeners. Let's hear from Richard in Oakland. Hi, Richard. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I think your guest has done a brilliant job of identifying and highlighting a major problem, but her suggestion that accountability is the problem, I think, is a false premise. I think that prevention is probably the solution, or a solution to a system problem. I mean, sexual abuse seems to be universal. It must be a human failing that's proven itself to be recurrent, and using her words, across the board. So if peacekeeping missions are going to continue to be used, we need to be honest with ourselves and understand that this whole sexual issue is a universal problem, and some system problem needs to be put into place. But accountability, I don't think that that's going to resolve the universality of it, and the whole idea of, especially in these more or less chaotic environments that these, quote, peacekeepers find themselves in, who are only human and subjected to human failings.
Well, Richard, thank you. I mean, as you were talking, I was thinking about the shows that we have done about rampant sexual abuse and rape within the U.S. military, on college campuses. I mean, we've done so many shows about this, and this is the big question, Ramita. In so many cases, the systems in place protect these people, and the people at the top just don't want to take put steps in place that would actually, in some cases, jail people who are doing this. I mean, that's what it comes down to, criminal accountability. So how would you address Richard's question?
Well, I would say yes, prevention, of course, is important. First of all, yes, this is universal. Yes, prevention is important. But no matter all the reforms that the UN has put in place with regards to prevention, haven't changed anything. That's why what needs to change now is criminal accountability, because systems haven't been put in place to change criminal accountability. You know, with regards to prevention, you know, they have training programs. So now all peacekeepers are given training before they go out to their missions. There are checks and balances now that weren't in place before. There are outreach projects. There are projects with local communities to help them to become more aware and not so naive and not so trusting. It's not working. You know, the figures show this. It's still happening. What hasn't changed is criminal accountability. You know, we're looking at the same figures. Only 53 uniformed peacekeepers ever have been jailed. There have been thousands of allegations. Only one international civilian has ever been jailed. So people are allowed to get away with it. They're getting away with it. And that's not a healthy message.
Well, thank you for the call, Richard. We have a tweet from Rachel who says, I hate to lend credibility to anything the Trump administration says about the UN, but how can they tolerate even 1,000 cases?
I mean, it's a really interesting, you know, we asked everybody that we spoke to, and these are real critics of what is happening with the sexual abuse scandal in the UN. You know, what do you think of the future of peacekeeping? Every single one of the people we spoke to, including absolute critics of the UN on this point, still believed in UN peacekeeping. As did I, actually. Being on the ground there, I could see for myself how important UN peacekeeping is, despite this. And it's a really tricky one. You absolutely have to stamp this out, but that's the problem. The UN is not doing enough to stamp this out. I mean, the UN would argue, to be fair to the United Nations, they are trying, and they are writing reports and they are implementing changes. They're trying very hard. They're being very transparent. But it comes down to instituting real change needs the member states on board. The UN is made up of the member states. If they don't agree to adopt policies, for example, regarding accountability, regarding jurisdiction of their people, of their troops, then it's not going to change.
Well, thank you for the tweet. If you have any questions or comments for our guest today, we are talking about the new documentary that airs tonight on PBS, UN Sex Abuse Scandal. Ramita Navai, an award-winning reporter, went to many countries to interview people on the ground about this crisis and what is being done about it. She spoke with so many children who say that they were exploited, abused and raped by UN peacekeepers. You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can tweet us at Your Call Radio or email yourcall@kalw.org. We have a follow-up from Rachel who says, can you describe the vetting process for these so-called peacekeepers? What standards are they held to during vetting and training? Who is in charge of recruitment? How does all of this happen?
Now, that's a really interesting question, and that's a really important question. What we found is that the UN is not up to scratch when it comes to vetting their troops. And again, the UN would say, listen, we're doing better and better at this. We have better and better vetting mechanisms. But I'll give you an example. You know, a few years ago, the Congolese troops from the Democratic Republic of Congo that were sent to the Central African Republic, the UN had already noted that they had been killing and raping in their own country. So much for vetting. I mean, we spoke to quite a few experts who said these guys should never have been blue helmets. But, you know, at the same time, we spoke to Isabel Coleman, who you mentioned before, a former U.S. ambassador to the UN, and she told us, look, it's true, you know, vetting isn't good enough, but it's all very well to talk about how great your troops are going to be, but when you've got potential genocide on your hands, you need troops on the ground yesterday. How fussy are you going to be? So sometimes the UN is in a really difficult situation. At the moment, there's been a lot of talk about Sri Lankan peacekeepers. Sri Lankan human rights groups have done a lot of research that has shown that Sri Lankan peacekeepers, some of them have been found to have been involved in rape, torture and murder in their own country, in Sri Lanka, and are currently serving as peacekeepers. So something is going wrong with vetting, even though the UN says they're getting much better at vetting. But that's a really important point.
Kathy in Berkeley has a question. She wants to know, why aren't there women peacekeepers, or are there?
There are women peacekeepers. So peacekeepers aren't all soldiers, so you can be a civilian peacekeeper. But we met, you know, we hung out with the Uruguayan peacekeeping force, and there were women soldiers. There were soldiers, female soldiers from Mali, I noticed on the ground. But of course, yeah. So that's the military side of it. But you can be a civilian peacekeeper, So you're just, you know, working for a UN mission in a peacekeeping country, and you're non-uniformed, and there are plenty of women.
Thank you for the question, Kathy. Let's talk about Didier Bolgué. You mentioned him earlier. In 2004, he was stationed in the Democratic Republic of Congo, working at the UN in Goma, in charge of transport and logistics. He was earning $7,000 a month. And in 2004, he was 40 at the time. You spoke with Valerie, who was 14-year-old at the time, and she said that Didier Bolgué raped her, and every time he raped her, he gave her money, $2, $5, $15. He raped her for 6 months, and she ultimately found out that he was doing this to many other girls. Let's talk about how he got arrested, because you report that he was arrested in a sting operation in 2004 before being handed over to French authorities. He was charged with rape. International media attention focused on this in 2005, and then French authorities charged him with the possession of hundreds of child pornographic images and the rape of at least 20 young girls in the Congo. Despite all of these allegations, the French judge sentenced him to just 9 years in jail for the rape of two minors. Now, even though he was charged for raping only two minors, you report that he is the exception, not the rule.
Yes. So this is a really horrific story. You know, this is kind of the UN's notorious case, where he, as you said, was caught in a sting operation, and he had been filming some of his rapes, taking pictures, and these pictures were found on his hard drive. And this is the only case of a civilian, as I said, of an international civilian peacekeeper that has been jailed for what he did. And he admitted to us on camera, he admitted to raping 20 to 25 children when he was in Congo. He can't even remember. And he justified this by saying that he gave them money, and he said this was chilling. He thought maybe they knew what they were doing. He couldn't be sure when I asked him, you know, do you think they understood? Because he said that he would sit the children down before he raped them, and he would explain what he was about to do. That was how he justified himself. And he said, well, I think so, maybe not. Talking to him was pretty terrifying, and it was also terrifying because he was talking about the culture at the time, which to an extent still exists, of personnel, UN personnel, and we've seen this as well with charity workers who work in countries such as Congo, thinking it was acceptable to have sex with prostitutes. I mean, he was saying, look, I just happened to be having sex with underage prostitutes, underage children. they were his words. But he said, it was the done thing. Everybody was having sex with prostitutes.
And so what was it about his case? Why is he one of the few that has been jailed? And this was back in 2004. If the French actually took action in this case, why haven't they taken action in other cases?
So the big issue here is the extraterritorial jurisdiction. And what that means is that the country where you're from needs to have extraterritorial jurisdiction with the country that you commit a crime in for them to be able to sentence you back home and try you for a crime that you've done in that country. And about half of all member states, can't remember the exact figure, don't have extraterritorial jurisdiction. And this brings us back to accountability, which means that if you're caught, the most the UN can do is sack you. They can hand you over to your home country, but your home country will say, well, nothing to do with us. We don't have extraterritorial jurisdiction. And that's the problem. And Bolgué, you know, even though he admitted that he had raped, you know, 20, 25 children, as you said, they only had enough evidence to charge him, to finally commit him to prison for two rapes of two children, one of whom was 12 years old. And that's because they couldn't gather enough evidence. They didn't have full names. They didn't have all the witnesses. They didn't have testimonies, even though he had admitted to himself after having raped so many more.
And what is Borge doing today?
Well, after he came out, he was caught again in France for exposing himself to a child in a swimming pool. He went back in prison. So when we spoke to him, he's been out of prison now for a little bit. He's homeless, although he does have money in the bank. But at the moment, he's homeless. He keeps his possessions in a wood. And he says that this is a compulsion that he fights. He's a sick man.
Mm. And is he getting any help?
He's trying to get help. So he's seeing psychotherapists. But when I spoke to him, certainly I wasn't convinced that he was remorseful. I wasn't convinced that he feels guilty. I think he doesn't understand the lives that he has ruined. And I think it is because he feels that he gave these children something in return. You know, that's crucial. He sees it as somehow consensual, which, of course, is stomach-churning.
It is stomach-churning. Today we are talking about a new documentary that is airing on Frontline tonight called UN Sex Abuse Scandal, and Ramita Navai is an award-winning journalist who has reported from 35 countries. She went to many countries for this documentary to interview children on the ground, to interview UN officials, and in some cases, she interviewed perpetrators. If you have any questions or comments for Ramita, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also tweet us at Your Call Radio or email yourcall@kalw.org. Ramita, you also have a scene in the documentary in which people from Congo were eventually expelled and several were charged with rape in Congolese courts. They remain in jail awaiting trial. Can you talk about those trials?
So the UN introduced, this is one of the measures that they introduced a few years ago. They introduced measures where perpetrators from countries could be countries that behaved badly, that raped, that abused, could be named and shamed. And the Secretary General was given new powers to evict them, to kick them out of the country. And this is what happened with the Congolese troops. They were found to be raping, abusing, exploiting, among other things, just running amok in the Central African Republic, in the country where they were supposed to be protecting the population. So the whole of peacekeeping from Congo kicked out, kicked back to Congo. Congolese are trying them. To what extent are they really going to be given justice? Are the victims going to be given justice? To what extent is this a show trial? The Congolese simply want to get back into peacekeeping and want to show that they've got their ship in order. Yet to be seen, yet to be known. But certainly, so far, it's been a bit of a joke. The trial has been a bit of a joke. Over 2 years, there have been two hearings. Over 2 years, just 2 days of hearings over 2 years. And what we were told by Congolese officials there is that, listen, we can't afford to fly the witnesses over. So we can't have a trial without witnesses. So it's stalled, and it's just stuck in the system. Meanwhile, the perpetrators are in prison, and more importantly, no justice for the victims.
Mm. At the end of the film, you reveal that so far this year, the United Nations has received 32 new allegations of sexual abuse and exploitation against peacekeepers. 32 this year?
Yes. You see, it keeps happening. The numbers that, you know, that don't debate. They keep happening. But the UN keeps logging cases. And like I said, don't forget, these are 32 that the UN has logged. Never mind all the cases that you find there where you just land and start talking to people in these countries, you know, then you realize that these numbers are just the tip of the iceberg.
what do you think will, I mean, this documentary is airing tonight, and this has received widespread media attention over the past couple of decades. Even this morning, I found a story called, let's see, it's about UN sex abuse at the United Nations among staff. This is a Guardian article. A Guardian investigation that ran in January points to a culture of impunity as UN employees allege offenses, including rape. So we're talking about the rape of some of the most vulnerable people around the world, but also rape within the UN among staff members.
Yes, I mean, what people told us is that UN needs reform on these issues and needs to get its ship in order. And I think, you know, in the kind of Me Too world, this is really the issue of our times at the moment. And I think how the UN will deal with this is really important as a leading organization. And, you know, we had someone tweet in saying saying that they hated to be on kind of the Trump camp and be anti-UN. But, you know, the UN, we must remember that the UN can be a force for good. You know, the UN does incredibly important peacekeeping work, yet it needs reform, yet it needs change.
We have all seen video of the various UN ambassadors from different countries speaking about issues of the day, debating issues, the United States often getting in the way of various human rights agreements. Have UN ambassadors discussed this issue as a full body?
There is often discussion about this. You know, this is something that is oft discussed. And the problem again is these reforms, you know, the major reforms that will work. We were talking about the Congolese troops, and let me give you an example there. You know, one reform, and it was suggested by a UN official, he's called Prince Zayed Raad Al Hussein, he's the Human Rights Commissioner. He wrote a report in 2005. One of his major suggestions for reform was to have in-situ court-martials. So, for example, with the Congolese troops in the Central African Republic, they would be tried in a court-martial in the Central African Republic. So there you would have your witnesses, you'd have evidence, and this is vital. So you don't lose evidence, and you've got your witnesses to hand. And this is one reason that troop-contributing countries say, listen, we couldn't try our troops. We really wanted to, but there wasn't evidence. There wasn't witnesses. So this is one way you could get around it. And this is discussed between member states, with the Secretariat, with UN ambassadors, yet the member states reject this time and time again. So, you know, to what extent can the Secretary General put pressure on the member states to adopt this? I think that's crucial, that at some point, you know, that the Secretary General, the Secretariat, have to make a stand and have to be stricter and stronger on the member states to institute change.
Ramita, you interviewed a number of UN officials who have since left. You also reached out to current UN officials, and they told you that they would reach out to some of the young children that you interviewed and identified. Do you have any status on that? Are they reaching out to them? Has anything come of that?
In most cases, the young children, the children and the women that we spoke to, were contacted by the UN. They had initial meetings. In most cases, it was one or two meetings and it petered out. In one case, and this was a case of a young woman called Morissette. Now, Morissette lives in a town called Bambari in the Central African Republic. September last year, she was gang raped, she says, by peacekeepers at a checkpoint. They happened to be near a medical center. We spoke to many witnesses. We spoke to the guys at the medical center, a medical officer who treated her, who told us that the peacekeeper, even, you know, one of the peacekeepers came down and kept asking after her, and she was in an absolute state. Now, the UN, when we spoke to her, the UN hadn't been in touch with her for a few months, and her and her family were devastated by that. We gave the UN her details, and we, the last time we checked up on her, she still hadn't heard from them. She was bitterly disappointed. Bitterly disappointed. Initially, she'd got counseling session, but that's about it. And she wants more. You know, she's left to pick up the pieces.
How do you plan to follow this story? Are you going to keep in touch with the people that you interviewed on the ground?
Yes, I mean, every single woman and nearly every single child, guardian of the children we spoke to, told us that they wanted us to pass on their cases to the UN. They wanted help. They want psychosocial counseling. You know, they want to know if they can be compensated. And certainly, we have been following up all the cases. But it's difficult. So Morissette, it took us a while to find her because there was renewed fighting last month where Morissette is. So Morissette again had to flee, her whole family had to flee their home, the home we interviewed her in. She's now living in a refugee camp. So you can imagine all the obstacles people have to endure on top of having been raped.
Mm. And Ramita, just briefly, we have about 15 seconds left. What can people do to raise their voices on this issue?
Create a storm. Write to the UN. Make your voices heard. Tweet about this, but write to the UN. Write to your member states. Write to the your UN, your ambassadors to the UN. That's what you can do.
Ramita Navai is an award-winning journalist who has reported from 35 countries. She reported for the new documentary, the Frontline documentary, UN Sex Abuse Scandal. It airs tonight on PBS. I hope you can watch this documentary. It'll most likely be online, what, tomorrow, Ramita?
Yes, should be online after broadcast.
Okay, great. And you can find the trailer at yourcallradio.org. Ramita, thank you so much for your reporting, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.